Colonel Churchill, Reel 4.
Right. As I say, I had this battle-dress tunic. I think the word is battle-dress blouse, which had belonged to Schooley or one of the other killed captains. So it only had captain's stars on the shoulder. And this had caused some confusion later with the Germans sometimes. With the intelligence people said, I see you wearing, have you been promoted up to lieutenant colonel from captain? So I said, no, this is a, and I told him, I said, this merely belonged to somebody else, but I hadn't got one, it was very hot there. But some of the dead were wearing these tunics, and so I got your people and Broch to give me one to help to keep me warm. I also have some photographs taken by the Germans at that time, and you can see on the sleeve of my shirt, and a few on the front as well, some of the blood stains from pulling, dragging manners over to my headquarters. My shirt I was wearing at that time, and the blood all came out and covered my left sleeve, I think it was, from the elbow down with blood. And they are visible in the photographs taken by the Germans.
So you'd interrupted the narrative there with you having this lunch with the Germans.
Yes. Well, there was this lunch in the German Air Force headquarters. We then got in the car again and went back and to the Fiesler Storch. This was, I think, at Salzburg, this place, by this time. Then we flew to Berlin, to Tempelhof in Berlin. Now, as a result of my experience of coming down in aeroplanes, German aeroplanes, I found that I'd been left alone each time in the aeroplane. And I thought about this, and I thought, well, now I wonder if I can do some damage to this aeroplane. This happens again. Now, the Germans were all reading newspapers and smoking, and they offered me cigarettes too. But as I do not smoke, I had turned down their offers of cigarettes because I'm a non-smoker. And they offered me papers to read, but I can't read or talk German. I couldn't do that, so I merely sat there doing nothing, looking out of the window. And they all smoked and read papers and so on. Now, I thought, if at Tempelhof they merely get out and leave all their papers all over the place, like this, I will try and set the aeroplane on fire, but I'll have to be fairly careful how I do it. I should be pretty well in the clear, because for one thing, I was a non-smoker, which can be confirmed. And therefore, if I get out and shut the door after me, having set this paper on fire, it will be a considerable advantage. Now, one of the things I had found in all my battle experience was one frequently had to write various rather quick messages. And often in the dark, it was possible to carry in one's haversack and so on, of course, electric torch and so on and so forth. But I had found it more useful always to have a candle and some matches. The torch is a question of getting batteries for them, which one couldn't do in the field anyway. So I always had matches with me, although I didn't smoke. And I also had, very often, a couple of candles. On this occasion, I had about half a candle, and I had some matches in a box. So I thought, well, if when they bang on the window, which they had done before, to tell me to come out, I quickly light the paper and puffed the candle. Anyway, put the candle in the middle of the paper and the matches as well, and shut the door after me. With any luck, all this paper will catch fire, and it might damage the aeroplane. It might set it on fire, or at any rate, it'll do a certain amount of harm. So when they hammered on the window for me to get out at Tempelhof, that is exactly what I did, and then got out, shutting the door firmly behind me. Well, I was met by a German full colonel, a Standartenführer, is his rank, I think, in the SS. And we started to walk across the grass to where the car was, a good long way away. It was a long way to walk. And finally, the pilot and co-pilot of the Heinkel either smelt the smoke or something of that sort. Anyway, there was shouting and yelling from the aeroplane, some hundreds of yards behind us by that time, and we all stopped. And the German pilots were shouting and yelling, and the group I was with the Standartenführer and so on, were listening and replying. And the man who could talk English turned to me and said, "Why did you set the aeroplane on fire?" And I said, "Set the aeroplane on fire? Yes, I see there's smoke coming from it, but I didn't set it on fire. I expected it was all those people I came with who were all smoking, but I don't smoke. So I expect one of them dropped a cigarette, and it perhaps has caught a light to the newspapers they were reading." So that was more shouting back to the pilots and so on. And they then said, "You don't smoke." So I said, "No." And the people who travel in the airplane would tell me. They offered me cigarettes very kindly, and they offered me papers to read, but I can't read. I don't talk German, and nor do I smoke. And so nothing whatever to do with me. So it must have been some of the people coming along. And that was shouted back at the pilots and so on and so forth. Anyway, I will say that the Germans were very quick. They brought out a tender, a sort of fire tender thing, which came and squirted the aeroplane with foam and so on. And I don't suppose it did the aeroplane any good, but they certainly brought this tender up pretty quickly. And it squirted, and we all stood and watched this while the aeroplane was squirted with this foam. And then we continued our walk to a car.
So they accepted your explanation?
What?
They accepted your explanation?
Well, more or less. I mean, it was a very feasible thing, and they had no other method of doing it, of doing anything else. And so it seemed a reasonable explanation. Now, we then got in a car and drove again, a kind of subterfuge which the Germans had adopted again later on one or two occasions. We drove, as it turned out, in a bit of a circle to make the journey much longer than it need have been. And we drove to a place where there were four little houses in a row, each in its own little compound. And all four of them backed onto a high wall with wire on it and so on and so forth. And I said, "This doesn't look like a prisoner of war camp." And they said, no, "You're much too important. We don't want to put you in a prisoner of war camp. There are instructions from the very highest, and you will live in great comfort in a private house." So I said, "I don't want to live in a private house. I want to go to a prisoner of war camp." So I said, "I'm very sorry. Those are the instructions. But it'll be much nicer here. You will have every comfort, and it'll be a great deal better. Come along in." So we then went into a German guard room where the Germans spoke a bit. Then we walked out of another door in the room into a little area where there was grass and wire and so on, and passed one of the houses and went to the gateway of the second house, which I went into, and there I found a perfectly good little German house in its own wired compound. And I was there. Now, there were about 10 Germans who came and were with me morning and night. There were generally two Germans there in the daytime and three Germans at night. And one of them could always talk English. And we did nothing. They got every day, food came in a carrier, warm food in a wire carrier of various layers of food and bread and butter and so on, roll and butter. And this stuff, the Germans with me, heated up in the stove because the house was well equipped. And the Germans, the two Germans of the daytime and I, sat down and ate our meal. It was a good house and had a proper bathroom and everything else, and there was hot water, and it was perfect. And I said, well, how long are we going to be here? And they said, we don't know. We merely told that you're to be here. Perhaps you will go into a prisoner of war camp sometime. And this went on and on. And then suddenly, the Germans said, we've got an interesting German officer to see you tomorrow. He is in what you might call the only German commando. His colonel is called Scortini. And he would like to talk to you, as you're both in the same kind of racket. So this chap came along. He could talk English. And he brought some magazines, some English magazines with him. And he said, I've come to talk to you about the war generally and ask you about your experiences and so on. And again, I said, well, I'm afraid I can't give you any explanation or anything, only number, rank and name and so on. And then he said, well, perhaps we could look at these picture papers, things like Illustrated London News, The Sphere, The Graphic and so on. And I was amazed at the information and the pictures in there of the war, all different places, and pictures of the Navy and ships and all sorts of things. So then I had an idea, and I said to them, now look here, I'll tell you what, you're going to make a report about this. I'm quite prepared to say to you what we can get out of these papers. The people you tell won't know that. They won't know that. But if it's already published, your intelligence people back in Berlin will know it all, because they've got all these papers. But it'll look as if your interview with me had been most productive. And I'm quite prepared to merely repeat what these papers already say, because I know that at the main headquarters they will know all this anyway. So he said, well, that's the most ingenious idea. And he said, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll ask if I can come back tomorrow, and I'll bring some vino, and we can have quite a session here. So I said, that's a jolly good idea. And that's what I did. He merely produced these English papers magazines, and then I said, look here, you better ask me about Singapore or something, and I will tell you what I know. And all this was stuff out of these papers, and so he put a great down, and he came several times, bringing vino each time, and said, they are delighted with my missions to you, and they think it's splendid, the information I've got out of you. So I said, well, ultimately, they'll probably discover when it goes to the proper intelligence headquarters that all this information they've got already, but that won't affect you or me. And so he laughed, and we were quite matey as a result.
What was his name? Did you discover?
No. I did ask, and it sounded like Schwinkerpink to me. And that is all I could remember afterwards, because I had written a number of secret notes on papers which were in the drawers of my chest of drawers. On the back, they were ornamental paper like we had in chest of drawers, and the other side was plain white, and that was the only paper I had. But I had a pencil, or the Germans gave me some pencils or something. But I was never allowed to write letters or receive letters. And I kept clamoring to the Germans about this. And I said, when am I going to go to a prisoner of war camp? And when am I going to be allowed to write home and receive letters and a Red Cross parcel? Why don't I have a Red Cross parcel? I was banging on about a Red Cross parcel all the time. And they said, well, I'm very sorry, but you've got everything you need here. You don't need a Red Cross parcel because we have splendid food here and so on. But I suppose some sort of decision about your future will be taken ultimately. But it's nothing to do with us. And that was the position all the time with the Germans. nobody knew. But there were about 10 of them that, as I say, 3 at night and 2 in the daytime.
What happened next to you?
Well, then, suddenly, one day, the Germans said, now you're going to be moved to a prisoner of war camp this evening. So I said, oh, good, well, it's about time, too. I've been here 6 weeks or whatever the period was. It's quite a long time. And they said, yes. So you will then see your people, and then you'll be able to get your Red Cross parcel and write home and so on and so forth. So I said, well, I'm glad to hear it. And sure enough, late that night, a car came along, and we got into it. Again, there was one who could talk English, and off we went. Again, we drove round in a great circle, which I discovered. Because when I got out, we were only about 300 yards from the four houses. And on getting out, I could recognize the four houses straight away. And there was the continuation of the wall, which the houses were built against. And I said, look here, Fritz, whatever his name was. Here we are, as usual, we've gone round in a great circle and come back to exactly where we started from. This doesn't look to me like a prisoner of war camp at all. And he said, oh, yes, we have. A lot of these places look the same, but you'll find here you'll be with other prisoners and so on and so forth. So I said, maybe with some other prisoners of some sort, perhaps like myself for some reason, but it's certainly not a POW camp. He said, come on, again, go on, never mind about this. Yeah, we've got here now. And in we went. Now, there again, we made contact with the German NCO. We then went into a small compound where there's a wooden hut. And we went into the wooden hut and into a room. And in this room, there's a bed and one man in it only. There's another bed there, empty. And the chap in the bed jumped out and sort of stood to attention. And the German spoke to him in German. And he sort of nodded and so on. And then the man who was talking, he said, this is Lieutenant Rutchenko of the Russian army. You are sharing a room with him. So I said, oh, yes. So I said, can you talk English? And he said, nein. Ich spreche Deutsch, or whatever the German is for that, I don't know. So then he said something like, wait, arrête, stop, or something. And by Jove, he went out of the room and he brought in the English prisoners, Dave Douse, James and Dodge, or one or two of them anyway.
Who were these prisoners?
Now, I'll tell you who they were. Now, at Stalagluft 3 at Sagen, on the 24th of March 1944, they did a big escape. It was not a fully successful escape, as escapes seldom are. The plan was to get out 24. The story is fully told in The Great Escape and other books as well. As a result of this, the escape began, and about 70 or 76, some number like that, got out through the tunnel, of whom the last 20 or so went out at the hands of the Germans, because by then the Germans had discovered this escape was going on, and although the plan was to get out something like 250, only about 76, something under 80, were in the pipeline before they could stop the other people coming in. Now, Day, Douse, James and Dodge were all there. Day was a wing commander in the Air Force. Douse and James were flight lieutenants in the Air Force. Dodge was a soldier in the Middlesex, but was a wartime soldier and a very rich man. His background was Dodge Motor Cars in America, and he was a wealthy fellow. He and Day had both been in the First War for a short time at the end, and they were older than these two. The gap in ages between those and those was 20 years. These were about 47, and these were about 27. 26 or 27, and 46 and 47, that sort of age. Now, I came in right in the middle, 10 years below these and 10 years above those. I came in at about 37. So it made, when I got there, an English quincunx, or whatever the word is, with two down here and two up here, and myself 10 years under one pair and 10 years over the other pair. Well, they came in, and for quite a long time, we sat up and talked. And they wanted to know where I'd come from and all about me and so on. And I asked about them and so on and so forth. Then finally all we went to bed and we continued to talk in the next days.
Did they tell you where you were?
Yes, they did. They said, yes. Now this place is Sachsenhausen, the original concentration camp. The two main concentration camps, and the original ones are Sachsenhausen and Dachau. Sachsenhausen was the senior one and was on the outskirts of Berlin at Oranienburg. Dachau was the other one on the outskirts of, I think, Munich. And the two original concentration camps had been put there because there were big SS army depots nearby, so they had a good source of guards. Then, of course, apart from these two real ones, they made a lot of what I call red brick concentration camps all over the place. Now, I have got a map with all the concentration camps marked on it somewhere. But Sachsenhausen and Dachau were the principal ones, and Sachsenhausen was the headquarters of the whole shooting match.
Well, how did you react when you found out that you were in a concentration camp?
Well, I was interested to hear that, but at least I had now made contact with some English. And I got the story of why they were there, and they told me about the Stalingrad escape on the 24th of March, which the Germans shot 50, but the Germans had not wanted to shoot 50 anyway. And it was Goering who got the number kept down to 50, because when Goering heard about this, he went to see Hitler and said, Allhurst, what's all this I hear about shooting the Air Force officers? And Hitler said, yes, I was not too keen on it myself, but Himmler and Bormann and co. say we must make an example of these officers. They have been a damn nuisance. And they do, from Stalagluft, about one escape a year. He said some of the off-lags do escapes every now and then. But I think that this Air Force camp, Stalagluft at Sagen, is probably the best and most capable and best organized of them. And, as I say, Born and Himmler are very keen that an example should be made. And they want me to shoot everybody. Well, I finally agreed. And then Goering said, now, yes, I see the shooting has started already, but they're picking people up gradually all over the place. Can you not limit the number? And Hitler said, well, that's an idea. Perhaps I could go back to a Bormann or Himmler and say, I've decided that not more than 50 are to be shot. So this is what happened. So the Germans shot exactly 50, but they did choose all the foreigners first. There were, in the Great Escape, of those who got out, there were about 15 who were foreigners, Poles and Danes or Norwegians or French or something, who had been in the Air Force and had been pilots and been shot down and were in Stalingrad and had taken part in escape. So the Germans shot all of them, the whole 15, so there were only, I think, 35 English shot, but the number was exactly 50. Now, after the war, we sent a very strong judge advocates Air Force combined team over to the Nuremberg trials, and these who were shot, the background was gone into very fully, and they were pretty well revenged. I think of the 35, something like about 30 were pretty well revenged. Some Germans were shot as a result, and others got long terms imprisoned. Because one of the main lines, I think, that was taken up by these judge advocates when the Germans put up their defense, their statement was that they were moving these officers at night in cars, and when they were driving somewhere, they'd stopped for the officers to have a pee, and they'd got out in the dark and were standing on the side of the road peeing, and the Germans were just either peeing or waiting, when they started to run away into the night. So the Germans shouted and stopped, and they wouldn't stop, so they had to open fire on them. To which the devastating reply was given, how come there were no wounded? Did you then shoot the wounded and kill them? Why have we no example of a wounded fellow who did what you said? Well, the Germans couldn't reply to that. There were no wounded.
So you were saying that your first night had been in contact with these great escape officers. What happened after that?
Well, in the daytime, we all got together and exchanged experiences and so on. We were looked after by two Italians, and we got limited Red Cross parcel. We got a Red Cross parcel, I think, once a month instead of once a week. And these parcels, Day, Douse, James, Dodge, myself, so I suppose there were five parcels, were handed over to our two Italians who had become or were already the servants of the English. The Italians had been, we called Amici and Bartoli. Amici was a relation of Don Amici, the film star. He was a very nice-looking Italian, and it was probably quite true, his story. Bartoli was a bigger, tougher Italian, and I think he was an Italian grenadier or something of that sort. But Bartoli and Amici had been servants at the Italian embassy or legation in Berlin. And when Italy surrendered, the officers had all gone away, and the idea was that they were to go away too. And then at the last minute, the Germans had stopped these two and said, hell no, I don't think we'll send these fellows back, we'll put them in a concentration camp. So Amici and Bartoli were put in Sachsenhausen, or were put in to what was called Sonderlager A, Special Camp A. And this Sonderlager A, which was grafted onto the outside of Sachsenhausen, had five Greek generals in one hut, including Papagos, who became Prime Minister of Greece afterwards. He was the Commander-in-Chief of the Greek army, and his four corps commanders, so there were five of them. And as I say, Papagos became Prime Minister of Greece later. There were two Russian generals, Besenov and Privalov. Privalov was a very nice ex-Tsarist NCO and had become a general under the new Russia. Besenov was a swine, a bloody man, who had been a porter or something of that sort on the railway, or his father had been, I can't remember. But Besenov was a very tough Gestapo fellow. Then there was a nice Russian full colonel called Brodnikov with a von Tirpitz double beard. There was Rechenko, a Russian subaltern who was an ex-don at one of their universities. And he had been put in Sachsenhausen because of his mental background to try and educate the unpleasant Russian general Besenov. Besenov had been trying to get the job of commanding the Free Russian Division, which was going to fight for the Germans. Another man got the job. Was it Vlasov or some name like that?
Yes.
Got the job. But Besenov had been trying to get it, and the Germans had thought Besenov was an unpleasant, tough fellow who was pro-German and so on, would do very well if he hadn't been so goddamn ignorant.